Hiram must do the getting, friend. The charge was new, though not wholly without expectation. Harriet had pointedly been roundways in her description of what we faced. Perhaps it was to prevent me from thinking too much and carrying any apprehension. This was not Virginia, and I would be going it alone.
I'd like to go myself, she said. But Robert is upon the home plantation, and my workings there are very much suspected. They'll be looking for me.
You will be less likely to be suspected, and if you are, you have your passes that shall give you and Robert the right to the road. I nodded. So, when shall I leave?
Right now, friend, right now, she said. You must make it to Robert's place before the daylight. Then, wait, keep yourself out of range, and then, soon as nightfall, you and Robert head to my daddy's. Robert will know the way.
I got him, I said.
One more thing, Hiram, said Harriet.
She turned to Chase Piers and said,
Chase, get him that thing.
Chase went into a small cupboard and pulled out something wrapped in fabric. He handed it to Harriet, who then unwrapped the fabric, and now I saw that she held a pistol that glinted in the firelight.
Take this, she said, handing the thing to me. It's for them, but more it's for you. If you have to use it, then it will likely be too late, and you will want it for both.
So I walked back out into the woods, moving as instructed. There were secret signs guiding my path. And though it was night, the signs were visible by moonlight, more so because I knew what to search for. A star carved into the bark of black oak, 5 felled branches all fastened to the ground, 2 of them pointing east, a large stone with a crescent moon drawn on top, and a spade underneath. I missed a few of these, found myself turned around, but nonetheless I was at Robert's place before sunrise, and thus with time to spare. The Brodus plantation was not as lush as my Lochless, and the quarters were little more than hovels arranged haphazard in the forest. Brodus had not even bothered to have the trees cleared from around. And I thought if this chaotic arrangement gave any tell as to what it was like to task down here, I well understood why Harriet would like to forget. It was now Sunday morning, which meant no task, and no task meant no count, so the head man would not notice Robert's parting until the next day. We'd be in Philadelphia by then with Raymond and Otha plotting on the next step to Canada or New York. The plan, as much as I knew of it, called for Robert to step out of his quarters just before sunrise, whistle once, and then walk to the woods where we would meet. Once Robert approached, I was to speak a phrase to let him know my intentions, and he would respond with his own. Failing any of that, I would know that something had gone wrong and would immediately then head off myself back to Chase Pierce's cabin. And so I waited, at some distance, until I saw a dark figure step outside and look around. I heard a whistle, and then I watched the figure begin making its way out from the cabin into the woods. I walked toward the figure and said, "The Zion train is upon you."
"And I should like to be aboard," Robert said.
He was a normal-sized man, with a sad countenance holding none of the joy or confidence that Harriet's other family had offered. There was weight to him, and rarely had I seen a man woeful at the prospect of rescue from the task. "We leave at nightfall," I said. "Make all your arrangements, and then meet me here." Robert nodded again and headed back to his cabin. I retreated deeper into the woods. Though there would be no tasking this day, I did not wish to attract any attention. So I walked until the woods rose upwards, and climbing up a hill, found a cave where I kept peace until dark. Then, as the appointed hour approached, I made my way back. But Robert did not appear. I waited longer, and when he did not show, I wondered if Robert had staked at the wrong time, because I knew I had not. I thought to leave without him, for Harriet would make no exceptions, and I think were I back in Virginia, I might well have done it. But the months had changed me, and I thought often during those days since the New York convention of how Mukajah Bland had died, of how he could have left Lydia and made his way back. And I thought of how he would have rather faced Otha in the next life than in this one, having done such a thing. And I still had my passes should I need them. So there alone I made a decision to return with Harriet's brother Robert, or not return at all. I left the wood to check on his cabin. As I approached, I heard a woman yelling, and through the open door I saw the woman pacing about and Robert on the bed with his head hung between his hands. I watched from outside for a moment as the woman inveighed against Robert with a mixture of rage and pain.
"I know you're leaving me here for some social with that Jennings girl," she said. "I know you, Robert Ross. I know you are leaving me, and you had better be an honorable man and say it as such."
"Mary, it's just like I done said. I'm going to see my brother and my ma and pa," said Robert. "Ain't nothing but a Sunday. You know this. Look, there's Jacob."
And at this, Robert motioned out the door toward me.
"I told you about him from the Harrison place. He got people that way, too. Ain't that right, Jacob?"
Mary turned to me standing outside, looked me over, and rolled her eyes.
"I ain't never seen no Jacob," she said.
"He right there," Robert said.
"You ain't never need any kind of partner for the walk before," she said. "What done changed? I never seen this man before. I know he ain't from around here. How about I walk with you instead of him? I know what you're doing, Robert Ross. I know all about that Jennings girl."
I was in the doorframe of the quarters. I now stepped inside and saw Mary fully, a small woman with a righteous rage all over her. She really did know Robert, even if she did not directly know which way he was now heading. She looked me over again and said,
"Jacob, hum, how about I march over to the Jennings place and ask about you?"
"We ain't doing that," I said.
"Ain't no we. I do it by my lonesome right now."
"No, I can't let you."
"Really? So you saying you gonna stop me?"
"My ambition, ma'am," I said, "is that you will stop yourself." Mary shot me an incredulous look. I had to move fast. "You're right," I said. "Ain't no Jacob around here. But should you act as you now claiming to, would bring pain upon you and everyone you love in a kind of way that go far beyond finding Robert sneaking around with a girl." Behind me, I heard Robert moan and say, "Baby!" "Mrs. Mary," I said, "it is apparent to me that you have not been given the full shape of things. You are right. Robert is stealing away. Robert got to steal away, and there ain't a thing you should want to do about it."
"Damn if I shouldn't," she said.
"No, ma'am," I said. "I really don't think you should. I know he ain't been straight with you, but I will tell you directly. Broda's about to put this man on the block, and when he do, you will have a better chance of walking on water than seeing your husband in this life again."
"He been running that business for a year now," she said, "and Broda's ain't done nothing. Robert worked too hard for them to move."
"Robert working hard is the first reason to move him. Strapping man like that, fetch a good price, and what nigger ever been saved on account of working hard? You got that much faith in these people? I've been giving this place a good survey. It is teetering. I done seen many a farm like it before. They selling folks off 'cause they got to. I seen it before. I am telling you now, telling you straight, that your Robert got two choices, the auction block with Brodus or to run with me." If there was an official rule book for the underground, I was in violation of its most primary articles. Agents worked hard to be seen only by those they were conducting. And they never identified their true business, preferring any number of other stories. But I had given it all up in hopes, with time against us, of swaying Mary to let us go. "The underground offers the chance at reunion," I said. "I hate to divide you. I know what it is. I tell you, I do. I am divided myself. Got a gal down in Virginia who I think of every minute of every hour of every day. I was forced from her, but better to be forced north by the underground than be forced deeper into the coffin. This is the only way, I am telling you. I have heard the two of you are new with child, and I know what must weigh on you. I was an orphan, Mrs. Mary. My mama was sold away and my daddy wasn't worth spit. I know you must be fearing that child coming up without a daddy, and I have a feeling for that stronger than you can know. But you have got to get this man. Your Robert will be taken, either by us or by them, but he will be taken. You know who we are. You know what we do, And you know our sign. We are people of honor, ma'am, and I tell you, upon my word, we will not rest until you and your Robert are brought into reunion. She stood there dazed and fell back a step. She moaned,
"No, no,"
and shook her head. And I remembered in that moment Sophia moaning when the hounds closed in. But just as swiftly I remembered something else. Back in Virginia, at Bryston, before we were to leave to rescue Parnell Johns, I remembered how much I distrusted it all, and how Isaiah Fields became Makaja Bland, and how his trust in me gave me trust in all the everything that followed. And that was the spirit I summoned up just then. "My name," I said. "My name is Hiram, ma'am. Your Robert Ross is my passenger, and I am his conductor. On my life, ma'am, he shall not be lost, and nor shall you." A soft tear rolled down Mary's cheek. She gathered herself a moment and then brushed past me.
"I swear, Robert, if this is a girl, I will find you, and I am telling you that this man, this Hiram, and his high words, they will not save you."
I felt I should look away. They deserved the moment, for there would be not another in some time. But thinking back on all that, I said, thinking back on Virginia, thinking back on Sophia, I could not move. Robert pulled her close. He kissed her warm and soft.
"Not running to no girl, Mary," he said. "I'm running for a girl, and that girl is you."
That fight with Robert and Mary set us back some. Without it, we could have done the trip across the backwoods and been to Harriet's parents' place well in time for our departure. But now we must take the roads, which was not ideal. Harriet, prophet that she was, had foreseen this. I had the passes. So it was to the roads, then. I was trusting to Robert, who now directed us to the home of their mother and father, Ma Ritt and Pop Ross. Harriet had kept every portion of the plan in its own box so that should any of us be taken, none, no matter how beaten and whipped, would be able to sketch the full picture. Robert was quiet for the first portion of the trip, reserving his words solely for directions. I let him be. Whatever my curiosities, the parting had been hard enough, and I had no intentions whatsoever of asking him to relive it. But then it happened, as it always does with me, at a certain point, Robert just started talking.
"You know the plan was to leave her, don't you?" he said.
"Yep, and that's precisely how it played," I responded.
"Ain't what I mean," Robert said. "Plan was to leave her for good. For me to get on by my lonesome and find a new life up in the north."
"And your child?"
"Ain't no child. Not of mine, at least. I know that. And she know that."
We were quiet for a minute. "Brodus?" I said.
"Brodus' son," Robert said. "Him and Mary about the same age, played together as kids, then was parted, as we all are. I guess he had a thing for her even back then. And now a man, he thought he would make good on those feelings, no matter how fixed and honest Mary was. Maybe she felt the same. She surely ain't stop him."
"And how was she to do that?" I asked.
"Man, I don't know," Robert said in frustration. "How anybody do anything down here? But I am telling you, I'll be damned if I'm going to be raising some white man's child."
"So you run, then?"
"So I run, then."
"Brutus wasn't about to sell you, was he?"
"No, he was. I ain't know when, but he was. For a while, I thought that might well be a relief from my position. I did not have any desire to see Natchez, but if it helped me forget Mary and my humiliation, perhaps it was for the best."
"A man being sold ain't never for the best."
"Yeah, I know," Robert said. "Harriet and the family got to me, pulled me out of my despair, told me that some other life might yet await me in the north. They ask about Mary and the baby, of course, and I tell Harriet, no way I'm going with some other man's child. She ain't like that. Ain't like that much at all, but I tell her either it's going to be new life and everything, or I'll just take my chance with Brodus. But when time come to leave, when I really had to face up to what it mean to leave my Mary, I don't know. Best I can say is
I got weak and started thinking maybe some of the old ain't so bad. And then you come in and make your promise.
I'm sorry about that, I thought.
Nothing to be sorry about, whatever. Fact is, you were saying what I was feeling. I can't live without Mary. I don't want no freedom that ain't about some place with her. It's just that child raising some other man's baby. It grind on a man in a kind of way.
Yeah, it do, I said. And I felt it. I understood. But I also had begun to understand more, for I was thinking not just of myself and my Sophia, not just of Robert and Mary, but that day, upstate, the day I met Kesia. And I was thinking back to that great university of slaveries and tasks, and of the women in overalls, and the vast conspiracy to pillage half the world. And I was thinking of my part in that pillage, of my dreams, of the Lochless I had built in my mind, built mostly out of my Sophia.
We can't ever have nothing pure, Robert said. It's always out of sorts. Them stories with their knights and maidens, none of that for us. We don't get it pure. We don't get nothing clean.
Yeah, I said, but neither do they. It is quite a thing, a messy, dirty thing, to put your own son, your own daughter, to the task. Way I see it, ain't no pure, and it is we who are blessed, for we know this.
Blessed, huh?
Blessed, for we do not bear the weight of pretending pure. I will say that it has taken some time for me to get that. Had to lose some folk and truly understand what that loss mean. But having been down, and having seen my share of those who are up, I tell you, Robert Ross, I would live down here among my losses, among the muck and mess of it, before I would ever live among those who are in their own kind of muck, but are so blinded by it, they fancy it pure. Ain't no pure, Robert. Ain't no clean.
Chapter 25. By night, we'd arrived at a small path, which led into a clearing and then to the Ross place. I saw a house and then a stable behind it. I remembered then that Harriet's parents were free, and their children were not.
"Can't see my mama," Robert said.
"Why not?" I asked.
"She wear her feelings out front, and if she was to see me, if she was to know, she'd holler like a baby. And when the white folks come to ask what happened, no way my mama could lie. Harriet left here 10 years ago. I seen her since then, but she ain't spoke to mama. Ain't 'cause she don't want to, but how could she?"
At that, Robert gave a whistle. After a few minutes, an older man, who I took as his father, Pop Ross, he called him, walked out and, looking in no particular direction, waved toward the back of the home. We circled around, picking our way through the surrounding woods. Partway around, we caught a vision through the window of Ma Ritt sweeping the floor. Robert paused, suddenly aware that he might never see her again, and he kept weaving his way back. Around the back we found the stable, and opening it there, I found the entire party seated and silent inside. We did not speak. Harriet emerged from the corner. Her eyes were glued on Robert. She took his lapels, shook them, and then pulled him close into the strength of her embrace. And there we sat in the stables, waiting upon the safety of the deepest part of night. Some took to the loft and slept. Pop Ross brought us food, but opening the door he turned his head away without looking in and extended his right arm, waiting for whoever to take the tray. Twice I saw the old woman venture out to the entrance of the road, look off into the distance, only to return. I wondered if she had some notion of Robert coming. Now the rains started up. Ben and Robert peered through a crack in the stables which framed the back window of the main house, and through that window they could see Ma Ritt, lit up by the fire, puffing on a pipe, with the forlorn weight of her missing children all over her face. Harriet, who had not seen her mother in years, did not want to see her now. She did not look through the crack. She would risk no farewell, even a distant one. Finally, Ma Ritt extinguished the fire and went to bed.
I looked down and saw that a heavy fog had rolled in. Now Harriet inspected each of us. It was time. We walked out. I saw Pop Ross at the door, blindfolded.
"When they asked me, have I seen any of you?"
he said.
"I shall answer with my word upon God that I have not."
We walked out into the fog. Jane took one of the old man's arms, Henry took the other, and we fell into the muddy woods. And as we walked, Harriet's father hummed quietly to himself, then took up the familiar tune of Departure, and one by one they too picked up the song, and it was delivered in a low, quiet murmur through our party. Going up to the great house farm, going on up, for they have done me wrong. Day so short, Gina, night so long. Then the woods broke and we came upon a wide pond, the length of which we could not see past through the fog and the dark. The voices lowered until the only sound was the rain against the leaves above, and the falling water rippling against the still water.
"Well, old man," Harriet said, turning to her father, "time for me to take over."
I think they must have all gotten some understanding of what was to happen, because as soon as Harriet said that, Jane and Henry broke their embrace and everyone stepped into the water. Henry, Robert, and Ben formed a line at the front facing out onto the pond. Jane took my hand and pulled me right behind them. I looked back and saw Pop Ross standing there, blindfolded. Harriet walked over to him, circled once as if to take up every inch of him for her memory, then kissed him gently on the forehead. Then she touched his cheek, and I saw the green light of conduction pushing out from her hand. And by that light, I saw the tears streaking down Pop Ross's cheek. They stood like this for a few seconds. Then Harriet turned and took her place in front of her brothers, and started walking out into the depths. Her brothers followed silently, and Jane and I followed them. Only I looked back, and when I did, I saw Pop Ross there, still blindfolded. And as we moved deeper into the pond, I watched him slowly slip away from us, slip away as memories sometimes do, into the darkness, into the fog. When we walked into the water, just as before, it was not water at all. By then, Harriet was shimmering. She looked back past her brothers to me and said, "Don't you fear a spell? I got a chorus this time, and the chorus got me." She walked forward, burning brighter with every step, breaking the fog before us like the bow of a ship breaking the sea. Then she stopped, and the small procession behind her stopped too. Harriet said, "This here journey is done all on account of John Tubman."
"John Tubman," hollered Ben,
"who to my eternal heartbreak could not join us. This is for Pop Ross and Ma Ritt, who I well know shall be with us in the by and by."
"By and by," Ben hollered, "by and by.
We have found ourselves upon a railroad, by and by. Our lives be the track, our story's the rail, and I be the engineer who shall guide this conduction."
"Conduction," he shouted.
"But this ain't no bitter tale."
"Go ahead, Harriet, go ahead."
"For I done my grieving in a time far past."
Now Harriet's other brothers took up the response.
Go ahead, they yelled.
"John Tubman, my first love, onliest man I found fit to follow. That's the word. I have put my name on it for fact. Tubman.
That's the word, that's the word.
It began when I was a small pepper, for slavery make my child hands into grinding stones."
"Hard, Harriet, hard."
"A touch of measles nearly put me down."
"Hard, hard.
The weight stove me in, and vigilance came."
"Conduction."
"I walked out into the woods, testified, beheld the path."
"Conduction."
"But could not walk it till I was fully grown."
"By and by, by and by.
I worked the labors of man."
"Well, go ahead, Harriet, go ahead."
"Got me an ox team."
"Harriet got a ox."
"Hired myself out, broke the fields."
"Harriet got a ox."
"Harriet break the lamb." "The Lord put travails before me, made me hard as Moses before Pharaoh."
"Go ahead, Moses, go ahead."
"But I sing of John Tubman."
"Tubman.
Man don't like to be outshone by a woman, Moses break the land. John Tubman was not that kind. There it is. My strength honored him. My labors made him soft before me. Go ahead, Moses. Go ahead. And I love him because I know a girl got to love who love you. Moses got a big, bad ox. John Tubman loved my strength, loved my labor. Strong, Moses, strong. So I know he loved me. John Tubman. We planned for freedom on the slow, steady grind of work. Hard, Moses, hard. We had plans, our land, our kids, by my ox. Moses got a ox. But there was one who loved me more than John Tubman. That's the word, that's the word. The Lord give me vigilance, the Lord light the path, conduction. The Lord called me to Philadelphia, conduction. But my John would not come, hard, hard. I made my moves from the north and I saw new things. Moses got a ox. And when I come back, I was not the same girl. Moses break the land, but I was fast to my word, strong Moses. And I came back for my John. Yes, you did, and found him taken up with some other gal. Hard, Moses, hard. I stewed on that. I thought to find them both and make a mess of the thing. Moses got a ox. Don't care how loud I was. Didn't care if Brodus heard me in full fury. John Tubman. Didn't care if I was put back under slavery's chain. Hard, hard. But one man stopped me. Strong Moses, my daddy. Big Ben Ross. He grabbed me up and he say, Harriet got to love who love Harriet. Go ahead, Pop Ross. Go ahead. And my brothers, I shall tell you, like Pop Ross told me, got to love who love you. Go ahead. And it was my Lord who always loved me most. Go ahead. My John left me, brothers, but I knows it was I who left that man first, John Tubman. My soul was captive of the Lord, for it was him who over all again loved me most. Moses got a ox. John Tubman, strong Moses. Wherever you are, strong Moses, strong. I know your heart and you know mine. Strong Moses, may no vice come upon you. May your nights be easy, strong. May you find your peace even down in the coffin, by and by. May you find a love that love you even in these shackled times. That's the word.
Chapter 26. And there we were, early the next morning, before sunrise, down at the Delaware Avenue docks on the other end of conduction. Fog rolled off the water, obscuring the city. I looked back at the party and found a weakened Harriet with an arm slung around the shoulders of Henry and Robert. I took command and guided the group to our appointed meeting, a storehouse but a 2-minute walk from where we had appeared. There we found Otha and Tessio waiting for us. Henry and Robert laid Harriet down on a row of crates. She said,
"Now, don't you start fussing over me, you hear? I told you I was fine long as I had my folk. Served me well, don't you think?"
"That was beautiful, Harriet," I said. "I ain't never seen nothing like it."
"You'll see it again, friend," she said, fixing her eyes to mine. "You'll see it again."
Kessia rubbed Harriet's brow softly for a moment, and then she turned to me. She smiled silently and nodded her head, and in that moment I felt the import of all that I had just seen wash over me in a great wave of grieving and joy. Something I had long been searching for, a need that I felt but could not name, now clarified before me. It was Harriet, her brothers, her father, an entire family warring to exist as such. And I felt then that there could be no holier, no more righteous war than this. And now looking upon Kessia, who was my bridge back to Virginia, my bridge to my mother, my bridge to Thena, I felt her to be family, so that it was natural to do as I did in that moment, to take her by the shoulders and pull her close and hold her tight, and inhale the floral smell of her hair and the feel of softness of her cheek against mine. It was all so new. And I was so very new. A weight was falling away. The weight wasn't merely the fact of the task, its labors and conditions, but the myths beneath. My father as my savior. My plot to leave behind the street. My notion that Lochless could be redeemed by a special hand. My forgetting. I forgot my mother. And then went off into the house of Lochless like I had no mother. And then I was conducted, brought up out of the coffin, brought up out of slavery. And now I felt myself shedding the lie, like old skin, so that a truer, more lustrous Hiram emerged. Kesia said, "It's all right, Hi. It's all gonna be all right." And I felt her patting and rubbing my back in the way that one soothes a child. I tasted salt on my lips and became aware that I was crying, and now I was sobbing in her arms, and realizing this, I was ashamed. But then I looked up and saw that everyone else around me, the entire party Harriet had brought, Otha, Kesia, everyone, was hugging and sobbing too. We went in shifts by horse and buggy to the 9th Street office so as not to arouse undue attention. We were all there assembled by sunrise. Everything was timed perfectly. Raymond poured coffee and served rye muffins, brown bread, and apple tarts from Mars's bakery. We were, all of us, famished, and while doing our best to maintain manners, we fed ourselves to our heart's content.
"So this is what it is, huh?"
Robert said. He was standing off in the corner of the parlor by the window, watching the others as they ate. "This and more," I said. "Some good, some bad.
But on the whole, better than being held, huh?"
"On the whole, yeah," I said. "Still, there are parts of life that can't be gotten out of, and I have had to learn, here, that we are all, at the end, held somehow. Just that up here you get to choose by who and by what."
"Thinking I could work that," Robert said, "and I must say that I am even thinking that I must be held again by my Mary."
"Gotta love who love you," I said.
"So it seems." "You talk to Harriet?"
"I have not.
Don't know how to ask."
"I'll ask." Was I who made the promise. Raymond took in each of the passengers for interview. I took notes. It lasted the whole day. At night, everyone was dispatched to a different home in the city or out in Camden. They were advised to stick indoors, for by now their escape would be known, and Harriet would be the prime suspect. By the end of the week, Philadelphia would be prowling with Ryland, but too, by then, they would themselves be headed farther north. That evening I sat down in the parlor. Harriet was upstairs in my room fast asleep, as she had been since our arrival at the 9th Street office. Raymond was about to walk out with Jane and Henry to secure them in their lodging, but just before he left he said, "I thought this might wait until your return." Then he handed me a letter and said, "Hiram, I want you to understand that you don't owe anyone anything anymore. Not me, not Corrine." I sat in the parlor holding the letter. I saw that it bore the mark of the Virginia station and thus knew what it said before even opening it. I was being recalled to the muck. I appreciated Raymond's words, but there was no way I was not going back. By then I felt myself to truly be on the underground. It was who I was, and I had no idea what I would make of my life without it. And there was a promise I had made only a year ago, though it felt like 10 years, a promise to bring Sophia out. And even with Bland gone, I was starting to see a way to do it. An hour or so after Raymond left, Harriet ambled down the stairs holding her walking stick. She sat on the sofa and inhaled deeply. "So that's about the whole of it," I asked.
"Yep," she said. "That's about it."
"Well, not all of it."
"What you mean?"
"I ain't tell you, but to get your brother Robert out, I had to make a promise. It's Mary. She wasn't letting him go. I told her everything."
"Everything?"
"I know, it was not smart."
"Nope, not really,"
Harriet said. Then she cut her eyes away from me and let out a deep breath. We sat there in silence for a moment.
"But I will say that I was not there. I told you what was to be done. How you got it done was how you got it done. And I thank you for it." "This what Robert want?"
"Yes."
"That boy is a caution.
And there's something else, too."
"What you want now?" Whole state conducted?
I laughed, and then I said, no, I want you to know that I am leaving. Harriet, I'm going home.
Huh. Yes, I figured as much. Especially now that you done seen the power. It ain't that. And I still don't have it all.
Well, you have enough. Enough for me to tell you this. I want you to remember that I revealed this to you and only you. And I did this because you are the bearer, no one else. Don't forget that. Once you get that train on the track, and you will, there will be folks with all sorts of notions of how it should be run. You know what I'm saying? I love the Virginia Station, for their hearts are truly pointed toward the Lord, but do not let them pull you into their schemings, Hiram. They will try and pull you into all type of capers, but remember there is a price, always a price. You seen it on me when we went down. You seen it even today. There is a reason we forget. And those of us who remember, well, it is hard on us. It exhausts us. Even today, I could only do this with the aid of my brothers. If you need to speak on it, if you ever not sure, write Kessia a few lines. I am never far from her. If you need anything, if you find yourself under it, you talk to me before you try to handle it all on your lonesome. A man might be lost out there, no telling where the story might take you. Call on me, Hiram, understand?
I nodded and sat back. We had some more small talk until she tired. Then Harriet went back upstairs. I fell asleep on the couch. The next day I awoke to a gleeful exchange. Rising, I walked into the dining room and found Otha, Raymond, and Kessia at the table.
"Just brought these up," Otha said with glee.
It was the most hopeful I'd seen him since Lydia's capture and Bland's death.
"What is it?" I asked.
"It's Lydia and the kids, Hiram," Otha explained. "We think we got away."
"How?" I asked.
"McKiernan," Raymond said. "He wants to sell. We have been in touch with him through an intermediary."
Kessia then reached into a suitcase and pulled out a small book.
"It is not our way," she said, "but we must tell our stories."
She handed me the book and I read on the cover, "The Kidnapped and the Ransomed." I flipped through the book and discovered it was a story of Otha White's escape to freedom.
"Ain't this something?" I said, handing the book back to her.
"So then, what's the plan?"
"Otha and a few others will make a tour of the North," Raymond said. "They will sell the book to abolitionist audiences and use the profits to purchase Lydia and the family."
"And McKiernan, he gonna wait?" I asked, "after what we tried to pull on him?"
"You mean after what he pulled on us," Otha said. "Bland is dead, truly in the coffin. We ain't giving up on Lydia, and that man know it. Why, I hate paying a ransom for my own people, but this ain't the time for high standing, I guess."
"No," Kessia said, "it's not. If you got a way to get them out, Otha, do it. Keep your end of the yard clean and leave the justice to the Lord."
"Indeed," I said. "On that count, I have something that must be said."
"Time to get back, huh?" Otha said.
"It is," I said. I am not who I was." I don't even know if they understood. Perhaps Kessia did. But even if they did not understand, I wanted it said. I wanted them to know that I had been changed by Philadelphia, by Mars, by Otha, by Mary Bronson, by all of them. I wanted them to know that I understood. But all those years of holding my words, of listening and not talking, still bore on me so that all I could muster from this feeling was, I am not him. I am not him.
"We know," Otha said, rising to embrace me.
Chapter 27. Before I returned to the coffin, I had promises to keep. On a crisp November Sunday, I found myself walking with Kessia toward the promenade along the Schuylkill. The wind rustled its way up Bainbridge, this lovely thoroughfare.
Lovely, yes. I had come to believe this, for where I once perceived chaos, I now saw a symphony in the city,
in the low things in the alleys, in the abominable odor, in the great variance among the people spilling out of their brick hovels, piling into the omnibus, heaving in the pewter shops, bickering in the haberdasheries, haggling over groceries. On we walked, counting the numbered streets until we were at the river, which we followed to the promenade, barely peopled that morning. Kesia pulled her shawl tight around her shoulders and said, "We are not built for this, you know. We are a tropical people. That is what they say." "My favorite season," I said. "World is so beautiful this time of year. There's a kind of peace that just falls on everything, even up here. It's like summer wear the world out, and by October, everyone is just ready for a nap."
"I don't know,"
Kesia said, shaking her head. She laughed lightly and pulled the shawl tighter.
"This wind coming up off the river as it does, give me spring. Give me green fields. Give me blossoms."
"Season of life, huh?" I said. "No, I prefer this season of loss, this season of dying, for I think it is the world at its most true." We sat there quiet for a moment. Kesia took my hand and held it, slid over until she was close, and then kissed me on the cheek.
"How are you, hi?"
she said. "Lot of feelings," I said.
"Yes, indeed," she said. "These comings and goings, my lord, I feel it every time I leave my Elias back at the home place. Feel my heart ripped right out of me."
"And how about him?"
"Elias? Well, I like to think my leaving don't please him too much. But I do not ask. And you must remember I was always a kind of woman who would be hard to tie. Very few men could cope with this, but my Elias was different. And I think it was mostly because of Harriet. We are of the same understanding, so that when Elias fell to me, my manner was not so strange to him. Might well be the whole reason he fell to me as he did. I was what he knew. I was as a woman should be. We do need help on the home place, though. A lot of work, and I am not really a part of it. He keep talking about getting a girl. I tell him he can do that if he wants, but he will lose one, too."
We laughed at this for a moment, and then I said,
"Maybe not, though." "I assure you he will," she said. "Do not let that free love convention talk get to you."
"I'm not speaking of free love. I'm speaking of your mother." Kesia looked out to the river and said nothing. "Ain't right," I said. "Ain't right what been done here."
"Ain't right for no one, huh?"
Kesia said.
"You also aiming to go to war with Virginia?" she said.
"There were promises made," I said. "Promises before Bland died."
"Not for Thena?"
"No, not for Thena. I don't have it all figured. But I do believe I am owed something here. I am happy to be underground, happy that it all happened. But I was not asked into this. I was drafted. I do not believe it too much to ask that Virginia let loose the woman who made it possible for me to survive all those years before."
"No, it is not. And up here with just Raymond and Ulthur, or even with Harriet and Marilyn, it'd be done. But Virginia, they are different."
"I know," I said. "I have been tangling with them in some manner for almost half my life. But I am telling you, I am determined to get Thena out. I can't tell you how. I can't tell you when. But I will get her out." Kesia sat back and looked out toward the river. A knot of sparrows then flew up from the trees. I watched as a harrier dipped and dived among them.
"Well, I can't say I would not love to have her," Kesia said. "But you will forgive me if I do not get my blood up over such a thing. I said goodbye a long time ago, hi, and it is a hard thing to say goodbye to your mother, do you know?"
"I do," I said.
"If you find your way to her and see her back up here, well, we have a place for her. Lovely farm west of here, Lancaster way. It is truly a sight, I will say that. And it is waiting for her."
The very next morning I dressed myself in the style of tasking men I had observed up here, those who dressed well above their station. Fine trousers, damask waistcoat, and a high stovepipe hat. It was still early, just about sunrise, but when I came down, Raymond, Otha, and Kesia were there. We sat together in pleasing conversation for a few minutes. Raymond had hired a private hack to take us all to Gray's Ferry Station, as the entire party insisted on seeing me off. The carriage arrived presently, and we boarded and prepared for the trip down Bainbridge. But just as we did, I saw Mars running toward us, hollering, holding a bag in one hand and waving wildly with the other.
"Hey, now,"
he said, as he approached us, and I greeted him with a smile and a doff of my hat.
"Heard you would be leaving us for a while," he said. "Wanted to give you a touch of something."
And at that he handed me the bag. I opened it and saw a bottle of rum and gingerbread wrapped in paper.
"Remember," he said, "family."
"I remember," I said. "Goodbye, Mars." When we arrived at the station, the train was there idling and the passengers were making last preparations to board. Scanning among the crowd, I saw my contact, a white agent who would second me should anything prove amiss. I turned to them all and said, "Well, this appears to be my train," and then embraced each of them. I walked down to join the milling crowd below and presented my ticket, boarded, and found my place in the car, one distant enough that I could no longer see this new family of mine, for I feared what might happen should I be forced to watch them fade from me. And I thought of Sophia then, and I thought of how much I would like to bring her here, to meet these people and hear their wild adventures, to eat gingerbread by the promenade, and watch white men wave from unicycles. And then I heard the conductor shout, and the big cat roar, and my descent into the Southern Maw began. Long before we crossed the border, before Baltimore, before the sight of the conductor walking the aisle inspecting every colored, before the mountains of Western Maryland broke into Virginia, I felt the change. To task is to wear a mask, and what I now saw clearly was that I would miss Philadelphia because in that city of noxious fumes I had been the truest version of myself, unbent by the desires and rituals of others, so that now the change I felt overtaking me, my chest tightening, my eyes lowering, my hands open and loose, my whole body slouching in its seat, was a kind of total self-denial, a complete lie. And when I stepped off the train at that Clarksburg station, I could feel the shackles clamping down on my wrist, the vice tightening around my neck. Having lived as I had, having tasted my own freedom, having seen whole societies of colored but free, I felt it as a weight beyond anything I had ever known. By the following evening, a Tuesday, I was back at Bryston, installed in my old cabin. Corrine offered me a day to myself. I spent most of it walking in the woods, imagining myself walking in Philadelphia, as I'd so often done. I thought again of how much I wanted to take Sophia there, and thinking further, how much I wanted to take Thina there, and it occurred to me on that day that I was happy to have returned, for I never wanted to again breathe free air with those two in chains. Bland had promised me he would convince Corrine to rescue Sophia. But Bland was dead, and so I must on my own somehow convince Corrine to liberate them both. There were obstacles to this beyond the death of Bland. Sophia was the property of Nathaniel Walker, personal property, so that any such rescue would raise his ire and raise suspicions. Thina was of such an age that the Virginia Underground would likely oppose her rescue, for it was felt that a life of freedom should first be given to those able to make the most use of it. But I told Kesia we would have it, and I was determined to make it so. I met Corrine and Hawkins early the next morning in the parlor of the main house, and walking through that doorway, memories of times past and my first visit to Bryston and the unveiling of its incredible secrets struck me. And I saw my old tutor, my Mr. Fields, my Macaja Bland, laughing as Hawkins related some story, and I saw him turn to me with the gravest look imaginable, and in his eyes I saw all the terrible knowledge that would soon be put upon me.
"Hiram," Corrine said as we settled down in our chairs, "when you tumbled into the river with Maynard, you achieved two effects. The first of these was relief. You saved me from a union with such a man and all the horror you might imagine that entails. And for that, I thank you."
"I took no pleasure in it," I said, "but at least it improved your lot."
"Two, boy," said Hawkins. "She said two."
"Unfortunately," said Corrine, "you also deprived the station of an entree into the highest portions of Elm County society."
"There wasn't anything high about Maynard," I said.
"Yes, but you understand my meaning," she said. "Now I am condemned to spinsterhood and out of connection with the ladies of that country. Had the union with Maynard been achieved, that connection would have proven fruitful for the strength and intelligence of the underground. I believe you can see how."
"I can."
"And so by Maynard's death, we lost an investment. Months of planning were gone, and we were forced to make do with what remained."
"She means you," said Hawkins ruefully, "had to carry you off."
"And while you have not given to us in the way in which we believed Maynard would, you have given your share. We know what you did in Philadelphia and Maryland. Have you made an acquaintance of the powers which a year ago you only dimly perceived?"
I said nothing. I did indeed have an acquaintance, but there was still something missing, something that would unlock that deep memory at will and allow me to conduct the train, as I wished, along the track. And even if I understood it all, I still remembered Harriet's warning, and I believed her when she said that the power was for me, not for them.
"We are not without gratitude or admiration, Hiram, and yet this hardly brings you to a settling of the account."
"I am here," I said, "as much as possible of my own will. Tell me what you need. Ask me. I shall do."
"Good. Good," said Corrine. "You recall your father's servant, Roscoe?"
"Of course," I said. "Brought me up top."
"Well, Roscoe has passed. It was his time."
"I'm sorry to hear it," I said.
"As soon as Roscoe started going down," said Hawkins, "your old man Howell sent a letter to Corrine here. He wants you back, in Roscoe's place."
"Recall now the intelligence we were to garner from the union between myself and Maynard," said Corrine. "Perhaps you would like to be the source of this intelligence. We desire a knowledge of your father's situation and the future of Lochless. Would you help us?"
"I would," I said. My suddenness shocked them, for I was pledging myself to return to the man who was my master, even if he was also my father. "But I need something from you."
"I would say you've gotten plenty," said Corrine.
"No more than I deserved," I said. Corrine now smiled at me and nodded.
"Indeed," she said. "What do you wish?"
"There are two still there, a woman and a girl," I said. "I want them out."
"The girl is, I assume, the one you ran with, Sophia," said Corrine. "And the woman would be your caretaker from your earliest days at the house, Thena."
"Yes, them," I said. "I want them conducted to Philadelphia through the 9th Street Station and Raymond White."
"Forget it," said Hawkins. "All you'll do is bring down Ryland, likely right on us. The girl who ran with you, gone again as soon as you get back? And then the woman who was like a mother to you? No, that don't work."
"And this Thena woman," said Corrine, "she is past the age when we can justify such a journey."
"I know the dangers and I know the problems," I said. "And it don't have to be now. But I want it on the books. I want you to promise me that when the time is right, that we will get them out. Listen, I am not the same man. I know what this war means, and I am with you in it. But I cannot rescue on a symbol. They are my family, all the family I have ever had. And I want them out. I cannot sleep until they are out." Corrine appraised me for a moment. She said,
"I understand. We will do it. At the right time. But we will do it. For now,
Prepare yourself. You leave tomorrow. I've already informed your father to expect you.
And so early the next day, I awoke, washed, and donned my old clothes, clothes of the tasking man, and when their coarse threading chafed my skin, I saw a black gate clanging shut before my eyes. So this was it. I truly was now back under. I felt an odd relief in this, for the chafing of my clothes put me in connection with all those who chafed under the task. I knew that Corrine had set the slave deed, the deed to my soul, afire, but this had no meaning in a place where the whole society thought me a slave. And I recalled then Georgie Parks, whose specious freedom was pinned to the arrest of any other colored who should aspire to rise as he did. I was not Georgie. I could not truly torch the deed that held me until the task itself was torched. I met Hawkins at the stables, and we brought the horses around to the main house. We waited there in silence for Corrine, and when she walked out with Amy, I truly understood the majesty of the Virginia Station's endeavor. I had now seen two different versions of Corrine, so far from each other as to not even seem to be the same person. There was Corrine of the Virginia Underground and the New York Convention, with her hair tumbling down to her shoulders, with a wild and free laughter. And then there was this Corrine, prim, walking before us as though royalty, her face impeccably painted, with that rose-like glow about her that all women of quality sought. But she was still in her mourning clothes, and now the ensemble had grown more elaborate, a black bustle trailing behind her, a black veil so long that when it was lifted and thrown back, it fell down to her waist. She must have caught my surprise, and Corrine could not help but giggle. Then, with an assist from Amy, she pulled the mourning veil over her head, and the game was afoot. It was a funny thing, seeing the country again from this angle. To see the woods I had sometimes raced through and all the geography I had navigated during the rigors of training. I could see all the birches, ironwoods, and red oaks alive in their beautiful fans of russet and gold. The mountains just beyond us, with their overhangs and clearings, where the world opened up and you could see the bounty of this deathly season clear for miles. But in my heart, I felt the fear of having returned to slave country and that this world now had eyes on me. By late afternoon, we had arrived at Starfall, and I knew almost instantly that the decline that had been in motion when I left had now accelerated. Everything was too quiet. It was a Thursday, a day of business, but as we rode into town, our only greeting was the wind whipping leaves up Main Street. We passed the town square, which had been, in another time, a place of bountiful activity, and I saw that the wooden platform where the highest men of quality would address the town had splintered and rotted and been left in disrepair. Buildings that once advertised fur traders, wheelwrights, and emporiums now stood empty. We drove past the racetrack, and I saw that the pine fencing from where I once watched the races had collapsed, and the green field had begun to invade the turf. I looked over to Hawkins, who was driving and seated beside me, and said, "Race day?"
"Not this year," he said. "Maybe not ever again."
We stowed the horses at the stable and then walked across the street to the inn. When we walked inside, this is what I saw. A large room filled with 10 whites, low by their appearance, seated throughout. None of them were in conversation with each other, preferring instead to be off to themselves nursing their lagers or their private thoughts. To the far right, cosseted in a small anteroom, there was a clerk, attending to his ledger. No one took note of our arrival. There was something odd at work, though I could not place what. I stayed behind Corrine and followed her over to the clerk, who never lifted his head. Then she said, "How goes the Kentucky Comet?" Now the clerk looked up, paused a moment, and said,
"Derailed this morning."
At that, Corrine looked over at Hawkins and nodded. He moved quickly to the door and locked it. Two of the men sitting at the tables now looked up from their lagers, stood, and went to the windows where they drew the Venetian blinds. And that was the second time in one day that I understood the genius of Corrine Quinn. I tell you, I was at a point in my life and had seen so much that I was prepared to believe that she herself had laid waste to the tobacco fields of Virginia. For what I now saw, looking around, was that the faces of these men, these low whites, were not unfamiliar at all, were in fact men I'd seen in training back at Bryston, and in this manner I comprehended exactly what had happened. Right there in the heart of once-storied Elm County, Corrine Quinn had opened a Starfall station. Within the hour, everyone was in meetings. I was excused from these, having my assignment, which would begin on the morrow. I walked out of the back of the inn, and then circled around until I was on the street where we had entered. I turned up the collar of my coat to my cheeks, then pulled my hat low. A manic curiosity had taken hold of me only minutes earlier. What of Freetown? What of Edgar and Patience? What of Pap and Grease, of Amber and the baby? I could have very easily asked Hawkins or Amy, but I think I knew